People have asked me, is how do you do walking meditation? I should have mentioned it before. Walking meditation is done exactly parallel to sitting meditation. So you have stages of calming down, stages of letting go in walking meditation. So the first stage is come to present moment awareness. You're just here. So whenever you're walking, whether it's in the corridors or out in the garden or wherever, you're just right where you are. You're not one step ahead of yourself, you're not one step behind. You're right in the present moment. So keep that stage number one, letting go of time. Don't worry about how many minutes you have to walk for, whether it's half an hour, 1 minute, whatever. It doesn't matter. Timeless walking. And number two, once you're in the present moment, timeless walking. Go into silence. Silent walking. So you're not thinking, you're not planning. You're walking just for the sake of walking, just for the sake of being. Not for the sake of anything else. You're not trying to get somewhere. Not trying to run away from anything. And just being where you are is almost like a metaphor for abandoning those two first hindrances. The future is not drawing you with desire. The past is not pushing you away with ill will. You're just right there. No desire, no ill will. Silent, present moment awareness. And when you get into that and you're walking meditation, then just to focus the mind even more. Just like in breath meditation, you focus on the breath, breathing in, breathing out. Walking meditation, left foot moving, right foot moving. In the same way in breathing meditation, you don't control the speed of your breath. Fast breathing, slow breathing, deep breathing, shallow breathing. Just let the body do the breathing. In the same way, walking meditation, you don't control the feet. Fast walking, slow walking, shallow walking, deep walking, it's all the same. Allow the body to do the walking. Just as in meditation on the breath, you allow the body to do the breathing. Your job is just to watch. And just like in breath meditation, you start by just knowing that which tells you that the breath is going in, or that which tells you the breath is going out. So here, that which tells you the left foot is moving, that which tells you the right foot is moving. You don't need to watch with your eyes, you feel with your mind. And as you get deeper into this, allow the movement of the feet to fill your whole mind, like the breath can fill your whole mind. From the very beginning of the left foot moving to its end, noticing every movement of the feet in the lower leg. Every part of the right foot moving, from the very beginning to the end, you notice everything, the whole lot. Until you fill the mind, so there's no part of any moment which is not occupied with the feet moving in the moment, silently. And because you're putting all the attention to just knowing, soon the mind brightens up and you get to the beautiful feet, the beautiful walking. I'm not joking, it's good fun. You think you're crazy, but you do get to crazy states in this meditation, and they're just so enjoyable. So it's the beautiful walking, the beautiful feet, the beautiful step. It's so wonderful just to move 1 foot forward. This is delicious. You really get into it. So you bring up happiness and joy in the walking. And I'm not joking, this will happen to you. You realize just how wonderful it is just to walk in peace, in silence, in the moment, filling your whole mind with something so simple and delightful, and just 1 foot moving. And that's how we do the walking meditation. So it's parallel, so similar to the breath meditation. So when you can do one, you find you can do the other. And in fact, you're doing the same thing. You're just letting go, going in, instead of going on. Make sense? Any questions there? Some people like sitting meditation more, some people like walking meditation more. Most people like sleeping meditation the most. But I don't need to tell you how to do that. Okay, the next question, or first question. Could you talk about the concept of safety? Yeah, the antidote to fear, shame, embarrassment, and the precedent for letting go. What are its causal conditions? What did the Buddha have to say about this? Safety. It's like kama. It's the you know that the nai kama? That's kama, it's like place of safety. security. Where can there ever be safety? The only place you can have safety is where you've got nothing to lose. Where you own something, you're never going to be safe. Because there's always thieves around. Forget about these locks. Thieves can get into any lock. Forget about whatever you own, your body. Forget about antibiotics. There are some viruses which can just get into your body and steal your whole health. Forget about attachment to your husband, your wife. There are some women, some men who are so sneaky that when you're up on retreat, so where can you find safety? Only when you realise you don't own your husband or wife. You don't own your body. You don't own your possessions. You don't even own your mind. When you don't own anything, when no one can take anything away from you, that's the only place of safety. Whenever there's a little bit of attachment and a little bit of self, even a tiny bit left, you're not safe. You're not safe from suffering. You're not secure from pain, disappointment, frustration, and all that comes with that. When you fully let go, that's the only place of safety in the whole world, in the whole of samsara. That's why the Buddha called it the far shore. He said this near shore is full of danger. It's got these five murderous enemies called the five khandhas. They've got, what's the other simile? It's this beautiful simile. It's like snakes. You have to carry around this snake. The three snakes, you've got to feed them and bathe them and look after them. I think that's greed, hate and delusion. And if you don't look after them, they get a little bit angry, they're going to bite you. And there's that, all these beautiful similes, I forget it all, which is in the sutras now. The beautiful similes of just how dangerous is this near shore. He said it's a far shore. And the way to get from the near shore to the far shore, the simile of the raft, that's where it comes from, the simile of the raft, is the Eightfold Path. You know what the Eightfold Path comes down to? The Threefold Path, Sila, happiness and wisdom. Now you see, I changed it around because it's usually called Sila, Samadhi and Panya, isn't it? No, that's what they usually say, virtue, meditation, wisdom. But I've got textual justification for this because samadhi is always meant sama samadhi, correct, real, perfect samadhi, which is always the jhanas in the text. And the jhanas are called, one of their names is sukha vihari, the happy abidings. That's what the Buddha called them, sukha vihari, the happy abidings. So real samadhi are the happy abidings. So the threefold practice is virtue, the happy abidings, and wisdom. And that you can't argue with that. That's Buddhism, straight down the line. So the threefold practice, the path which takes you into safety, is sila, virtue, your precepts, happiness, and wisdom. See the importance of happiness? That's what motors pushes that raft from one part to the other. That goes to the place of safety, from this near shore to the far shore. That's what safety is. Okay? And it's the antidote to fear, because if you don't get over the shore, there's always something to fear, isn't there? Because fear is, whenever there's fear come up in the meditation, if you ever come across fear, it's great to come across fear. It means you're getting somewhere in your meditation. When you get really afraid, I mean really afraid, terrified, because some of your cherished attachments are being poked. They're being poked and tested. There's a sign that something's happening. You poke and you test and you come across great fear in the meditation. Especially in this type of meditation we do in here, sort of getting into jhanas. On the way into jhanas, you come across some monsters you have to face. All monsters of your own making. The monster of letting go of your body. No one's going to be looking after it. You're going to completely abandon it. Who knows what's going to happen to it? Actually, it's so safe. when you leave your body in deep meditation, you come back afterwards and the body is so peaceful, so healthy, so fit and so safe. In the time of the Buddha, there's this one monk got into deep meditation, one of my lovely famous stories. Got into deep meditation, I was sitting there, not breathing, not moving. Some villagers, some thought on the way to the forest to collect some stuff, thought he was dead. So being devout Buddhists, they thought, we can't leave a dead monk to be eaten by the animals, by the crows and by the jackals. So they said the only right thing to do as a good Buddhist, like if you found me dead, would be to cremate me. So they put him on top of the funeral pyre. They collected some wood from the forest. They set it alight. And when the flames were burning, he was on top of it. They thought, no, we've done enough now. The body will burn now. And they were busy villagers, so they went out to their work. Into the forest and collected this and collecting that. And the following morning, you can imagine the expression on their face when they saw that monk go into the village on arms round. They'd only burnt him the day before. Which was that story from the time of the Buddha. It shows if you get into such deep samadhi, even if people put you on a pile of wood and set you alight, you wouldn't know a thing. And also, it's a strange thing, not even your clothes will burn. Fact. So, that's how to be safe. The more you let go, the more safe you are. So fear comes from what would happen if. Now the point is, you don't own anything. So give it all up. When you don't own anything, what have you got to fear? All fear comes from ownership. And ownership is another word for attachment. And when you actually come across fear in a meditation, go right into it. Find out what is the cause of it. What are you attached to? What do you think you own? Sometimes people feel they're going to go mad. You don't own your mind. Let it go mad. It's nothing to do with you. If you don't mind that, then you never go mad. You just get into bliss. Sometimes the power of the mind states, if you get afraid of that, it's just the mind. The body's disappearing. And you let it go of the doer. It's wonderful. Enjoy it. Have great fun. You've got nothing to be afraid of, except letting go of the world, letting go of your body, letting go of samsara. The only thing you're going to lose is not being born again, that's all. So nothing to fear. Shame and embarrassment, haha. It's crazy, what are you embarrassed about? Because you know that old saying, which when you're in your 20s, it's a great saying, it's so true. When you're in your 20s, you're really concerned what other people think of you. Young men have to be fashionable, young women have to be pretty, because you're on show. When you're in your 40s, you're so self-confident, you couldn't give a damn what other people think of you. When you're in your 60s, you finally find out that people weren't thinking about you anyway. All the time they're thinking about themselves. So in this meditation retreat, don't think, you know, what's someone else thinking about me? They're not thinking about you at all. They're thinking about themselves. Wondering what they're doing, how their meditation's going, whether they're nodding, whether they're snoozing, whether they're snoring. They're not at all concerned about anybody else, usually, most of the time, 90% of the time. Everyone's concerned about themselves. So why do you have to be embarrassed? Because they're not even looking. They're embarrassed about themselves. And you're embarrassed, no one's looking at each other, they're just looking at themselves. We're very selfish beings. How many of you are really concerned about other people's meditation in this retreat? You're just concerned about your own, aren't you? When you face it, you don't have to be embarrassed at all. Is that coming from ignorance and stupidity? And isn't it lovely to be free? You don't care what other people think of you. You're not going to be judged in this retreat. And that's marvellous. So forget what other people think of you. I'm not going to judge you. No one else is going to judge you. Don't judge yourself. Those are the causal conditions. It's just embarrassment. It usually comes from stupidity. It is. And fear comes to ownership. So when you're not stupid, you don't own anything. You're not embarrassed. Those things can't touch you. Can you please tell us a little? Can you please tell us a literal told story of an enlightened monk and of an enlightened nun from the Buddha's time? A little note from an enlightened monk, enlightened nun. Okay, one of my favourite enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha. You know that Kisa Gotami? Know her story? You know that she's the one who lost her son. The only son she had, he died. And she tried to get some medicine for him, even though he was dead. And the only person, everyone said no, the only person who said yes was the Buddha. He was just playing around with her, teaching her some Dhamma. Skillful means. Because sometimes if you tell a person, oh, don't be stupid, the kid's dead, bury it. It's not yours. But you tell that to a person, they don't understand. So you have to be like skillful. And what the Buddha said, okay, I can cure your son, or I can cure something. Go and get some, what's it, mustard seeds, I think it was, from a house where no one has ever died before. And of course you couldn't do that, because in every house somebody had died. And after a while, knocking on all these doors, have you got a mustard seed? Has anyone died in this house? Yes, someone has died. Sorry, I can't use your mustard seed. After a while, the penny dropped. But it's not just her son who died. Everybody's son dies. It's not just your father who has accidents. Everybody's fathers have accidents. It's an amazing thing when somebody dies and they're in grief. They think that's the only person who's died in the whole world. And they can't understand why everyone else is happy. Can't I understand? My father died. It's sad. The whole world should be mourning. They did that with Princess Diana, just so stupid people are. I mean, what? Absolutely ridiculous. You know, people went, even like in the United States, you know, they're sort of throughout the monarchy, sort of 200 years ago. They sort of mourn the death of a sort of monarch. Oh, goodness. So all of this sort of stuff. But she saw through that. And so as soon as she thought through that death happens to everybody, and she wasn't amplifying sort of the death of her child. You know what I was saying this morning about, you know, the being in the forest and being afraid, think it was a tiger coming, your eyes were closed, and you open your eyes and it was only a little mouse, a tiny mouse. And that happens so often, and you think, what's going on there? Fear amplifies. Defilements amplify the truth. When you're in grief, the death of one person who's close to you becomes huge. It's like a little mouse becoming a huge elephant. Defilement, stupidity amplify. And it's a huge problem for you. And she saw that it was just the death of the son. So what? Big deal. Better son, get on with life. Only she had enough faith in the Buddha, she became a bhikkhuni, a nun. And her story, the reason why I like this story, she was meditating in some little room somewhere with her eyes open on a candle flame. It's like the candle's behind me. And the wind came along and blew out the candle. It blew her out at the same time. She was enlightened. Do you understand why? Where did that flame come from? What was that flame? Was that flame real? That flame was dependent upon three causes: the heat, the wick, and the wax. When one of those causes was taken away, in that case the heat was blown away by the wind, the flame ceased. The word for ceasing of a flame in Pali is called nibbana. Exactly the same word. So that meant a lot to her. She understood what nibbana was. The flame, once there, has now ceased. Kisa Gotami, the nun, once there, had now gone out. She seemed non-self. She became an enlightened arahat. Who is you? Yourself is just dependent upon causes. When one of those causes is blown out, so are you. That's how she became enlightened. Through that metaphor. That's why she became a great nun. Do you understand? No, you don't. But if you do some more meditation, then you might. of that enlightened monk in the time of the Buddha. What's a good story of an enlightened monk in the time of the Buddha? As a stupid man, and he had a brother. Was it Chulapantaka? It's a very good story, because some of us think that, you know, we have to be intelligent, we have to have university degrees to get into Dhyana and become enlightened. And this guy was very stupid, and his brother was a monk, was an arahant actually, I think, and was teaching him, but he couldn't learn anything, couldn't do anything. And so his brother actually just lost any hope for him, told him actually to disrobe. He sent him to the Buddha to disrobe, and the Buddha said, no, don't disrobe him yet. And the Buddha gave him a piece of cloth and said, what was it, to wipe the cloth with your hand every day. And what was the words? Remember that Venerable Navatissita? The Chulapantaka story. He had to say a little verse. I think like something like, sort of white cloth gets dirty or something. And that was all he did. And he actually saw that, you know, what was once pure eventually gets very dirty. And he realised that's just the same with the body, with all people's body. And that actually was enough for this very simple-minded monk sort of to let go of all lust and all desire and craving. Because how can you crave anything which eventually gets dirty and gets soiled and loses its purity, loses its lustre? It's a teaching of anicca. All that is pure and beautiful and fine and lovely will eventually lose its beauty, lose its lustre, will decay and get dirty. And that was enough for him to become enlightened. It's a very simple monk just wiping a white cloth on his body day after day. He saw deep Dhamma that way. So there's amazing little stories from the Pali Canon. Just how it is that the nature of life is teaching us again and again, if we only have the eyes open enough to see. Of course, it wasn't just the fact of doing that, it's also a lot of meditation as well, and having the powerful mindfulness to be able to see what's going on and see the deeper significance of what's going on. So, okay, that's two, a monk and a nun from the time of the Buddha. Chulapantaka. Next question. This is not a question, just a statement. I was out the front watching a beautiful sunset, feeling peaceful and serene, while at the same time watching people in a hurry to get home, thinking just how lucky I am to be here. Yeah, imagine what it's like. Saturday. What do you do on a Saturday? You're washing, you're gardening, catching up on business, and all that work you have to do. Someone else is doing it today for them. You are free. You have nothing to do today. No housework. No sort of answering telephones. No going down to the shops. No fixing up computers. No sort of committee meetings with the Buddhist Society. Ah, isn't this wonderful? So free. No kids to worry about, to take to this and take to that. So this is actually the Buddha's perception of emptiness. He said the perception of emptiness is always relative. Empty of what? What are you empty of? What are you free from? What's missing from your life today? Family, home, work, business. Keep reflecting on that and you feel yourself so free. Oh, isn't it so lovely to have nothing to do? No goals to attain, no schedules to meet. You can go to bed at any time, you can get up whenever you want. You don't have to get to work, you don't have to face a computer. All week. Oh, isn't that great? So that's how lucky you are to be there. When you appreciate that, if you ever get really depressed through this retreat, fed up, just think what it's like out there. What you have to go back to afterwards. Ooh. Ajahn, can you please explain how to see sukha after meditation or while we meditate? Okay. Happiness is there all the time, but we miss it all the time. You know why? Because we're afraid of happiness, number one. Crazy, isn't it? Why are people afraid of happiness? The whole purpose of life is to be happy. When we're happy, when we find a little bit of happiness, we think we don't deserve it. It's number one. Guilt. The big problem with human beings in the Western world, we feel so guilty. Why should we be happy when all those people in Iraq are suffering? There's so many starving people. There's so many people in hospitals suffering. Why should we be happy? Why not? They want you to be happy. I want you to be happy. Don't you want to be happy? Give yourself the gift of happiness. That's the best gift you can give to other people, you being happy. Sometimes the idea of a bodhisattva, how's the best way can you help other beings in this world? By really sacrificing your own happiness and being a miserable person, does that help other people in the world? Being miserable. Have you ever seen any bodhisattvas who are miserable and grumpy? If you're going to be a service to other people in the world, be happy. Then you can serve. If you've got no happiness in your own heart, how can you give happiness to others? If you've got no love in your own heart, what have you got to give to others? Whatever you have is what you give. If you're grumpy, that's what you give to other people in the world. Grump. If you're miserable, that's what you give to others in the world. It's make other people miserable. There's nothing more miserable than seeing miserable people. If you see happy people, even you may be miserable yourself, it cheers you up. So that's the greatest gift you can give to others, being happy. So if you can't think you don't deserve it yourself, other people deserve it. I deserve it. I work so hard trying to make you happy. The least you can do. All these years I've been teaching you, the least you can do is to get to jhana for me. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for me or do it for somebody else. So what we do, that's actually... Are you happy now? There you go, that's sukha, that's happy. Why not? Why not enjoy it? People have this... If you've been to too many Vipassana retreats and too many other retreats, sometimes you get this idea that meditation is supposed to be painful. And it's supposed to be tough to do a meditation retreat. That's why a lot of people just... They won't come on a meditation retreat because they think, oh, I can't do that. It's just too hard. But if you really get into it, it's the most happy thing you can do in your life. You have so much fun on the retreat. You go back after, what do you do? I had 10 days of fun and bliss. Now, where did you go? Did you go to Bali or did you go to sort of this nice resort somewhere? Yeah, I went to this meditation retreat. Got up at 4 o'clock every morning. Actually, I got up earlier. Didn't have to, I just wanted to. And he ate sort of 2 meals a day, nothing in the afternoon, no TV, and didn't even speak a word. Ah, it's so wonderful. They think you're absolutely mad and crazy. But it's true, isn't it? You can get more happiness in this retreat than any holiday. And it's also, this is cheap. $270, isn't it? $250, is it $270 or $250 or somewhere around that, anyway. What a cheap holiday this is. Bliss, happiness, free counselling. This is a bargain. See, that's happy. 10 days of happiness. So, with that sort of mind, you can see, you look for happiness, you find happiness, and when you start to put a little bit of happiness in, it snowballs. You've all known me for a while, you know my attitude to life. I don't just put this on when I'm in the retreat, this is how I am in the monastery as well, how I'm in the Buddhist society. Putting forth happiness in whatever you do. And you get beautiful meditations, you get even more happy, it just grows and grows and grows. Deha Jambram. Is inner talk, is purely five hindrances or different from? Yeah, the inner talk is the part of the five hindrances. It's basically restlessness. When the mind's restless, we chat to ourselves. When the mind's content, we're at peace. There's no need to say anything. For 6 months last year, I didn't say a word to anybody, except to the kangaroos. Not very much to them. It was for just having nothing to say. You didn't need to say anything. So it's a hindrance of talk. And in this retreat, at least you realise the outer talk, how unnecessary it is. First stage, you've never done this before, it's really weird. You meet all these people, you don't say good morning, you don't say hello. And it's acceptable, and it's lovely. And you can have a much, much nicer relationship with people when you're silent. You're coming from the heart rather than from the mouth. And that's also, you're much more truthful to people. Sometimes, you have to say good morning to somebody when you're really feeling miserable. if you're really honest, you're saying there's a really terrible morning tomorrow, isn't it? You've got to sort of say the right words. So a lot of talk is actually lying. That's what sometimes hurts us when we're chatting. Just saying what's polite to say. So it's lovely being silent. You don't have to compromise your feelings. You don't have to force yourself to say things which you don't feel like saying. You're free. And after a few days of silence, you love it. And when it gets to 9 days, it is, you have to give up such a lot of happiness by talking again. You realise you are actually sacrificing something to go back in the world and to talk. You feel that in a few days. And feel what it's like on Saturday week when you have to talk again. Ooh, I don't want to do this, but you have to. And that's the inner talk is the same. When you really get to the start of meditation, you don't want to talk. Why spoil something which is so beautiful? The Buddha actually said, this mind is radiant. It's beautiful. Pabasa was the word. But it's not defiled by these defilements which come upon it. And you know that radiant mind, that's called an immature mind. It's radiant, it's beautiful. You, once you get to that state, you say, why on earth do I put all these carcasses of dead dogs with these thoughts? And as I said, it's a powerful insight to understand all thoughts are dead. And that life is alive, and the thoughts are just like still photos of them, of life. By the time they're taken, life has already passed. What you actually see in thoughts is dead. Finish. Cease. That's why thoughts are never real. They miss the point. So that's actually how to stop the inner commentary. So the inner talk, yeah, it is usually restlessness. And after a while it just disappears and then you're free. How far along the path can walking meditation take you? And don't say as far as my little legs will take me. That's very nice. Okay, people get enlightened doing walking meditation. So it can take you all the way to enlightenment, walking meditation. If you do it properly. So, you know, you get yourself really, really peaceful and still. And then just see everything disappear and fade away. So there's nothing left. That's actually how walking meditation can take you all the way to enlightenment. You get to upachara samadhi. You have to see that who's walking? No one's walking. It's the body is walking. Is the mind walking? The mind's not walking. The mind's just watching, that's all. Whose body is this? It's not my body. Sometimes you get into this walking backwards and forwards, you do it a long time, and you're not doing it anymore. You know, you're just watching, and somebody else is doing the walking meditation. It's a little experience of anatta. Okay, to make a resolution not to have an intention before a sit, is it the same as to control? Thank you. No. Controlling is like the control freak. Okay? And always controlling, always on your back. You know the similar I give? Person is in the taxi, wants to go to the airport, come on, take me this way, take me that way, don't go too fast, don't go too slow, keep to the left, let other people pass, though you're a Buddhist, remember you have to let other people in when they want to come in. And don't talk when you're driving, and don't put the radio on, and just drive very slowly. And that's actually what you say to yourself all the while. And in that simile, just the taxi driver will throw you out the cab. Who wants to be with a passenger who speaks like that? And that's what you do in your mind all the time. Come on, start meditating. Come on, watch the breath. Now don't watch it this way, watch it that way. Maybe I'll do metta meditation as well. Now metta meditation is not the right thing for now. Maybe I'll do a mantra. Which mantra should I use? Now don't do it this way, do it that way. Now come on, do it properly. Remember what Ajahn Brahm said, present moment awareness first. I should have decided for it. No wonder you can't get peaceful. So a resolution is just like a little bit of programming the mind, a guiding the mind. It's guiding the mind into letting go. If it's a real sort of a proper resolution of intention, it's just to see if I can give up control. It's the craving to end craving, the desire to end desire, the aspiration to end aspirations. You have to do that. So you just say it to yourself, present moment awareness, please. And then shut up. The mind, if you're kind to it and gentle and give it clear instructions, it will follow orders. The reason why it doesn't follow orders is because you don't give it clear instructions. It doesn't know what it's supposed to be doing. You sit it down and meditate. Have you really told your mind what it's supposed to be doing? The mind doesn't really know what the heck it's supposed to be doing. So yeah, if she hasn't told me what to do, I might as well think of things. And sometimes that happens. You sit down and don't know what to do. So the mind just wanders here and there, aimlessly. So one, give it clear instructions. Once you've given it a clear instruction, let it give it time to fulfill those instructions. Look upon the mind as like a worker. Now you have a small business and this is your worker. And you just tell it very kindly, please, just be in the present moment, okay? Any problem there? Okay, off you go. And don't keep looking over the shoulder of the worker every moment to see whether it's doing the job. No more than, you know, if you've got a boss at work who's always looking over your shoulder. Every 2 seconds. Have you done it yet? Don't do it this way, do it that way, come on. I want it done now. You've got to really do this. You know, paid all this money for this retreat. You've got to come and get something. Everyone else is getting something. You know, the interviews have been really, really good. It's only you who haven't got anything. Whatever else it is, you've got someone over your back like that. In your house, sort of, you can't work. You get confused and you rebel. That's what happens in your mind. That's why the meditation doesn't work. Give it clear instructions and give yourself time. Give the mind enough space to fulfill the instructions. So just say, present moment awareness, please. Present moment awareness, mind, sorry. And just shut up. And the mind will take a little bit of a while to come into the present moment. Okay, mind. Now, if it's not too much trouble for you, could you do silence? Okay. Be kind to the mind. Be gentle. Talk to the mind like you talk to a good friend, or you want to ask it to do a favour. And it will do it, do the favour for you. Okay, mind, can you just watch the breath, please? And the mind says, what do you mean, watch the breath? That which tells you what the breath is doing, whether it's going in or going out. Okay, do you understand, mind? Okay, I understand now. And just let the mind do it. So those are the little intentions which you can do from time to time, which work. It doesn't work straight away, because you've got to give the mind time to do the work. But something inside there remembers, this is the job, the task at hand, and no one's interfering with me by giving other orders. And it gives the mind time to achieve the goal. And it does. Okay, mind, beautiful breath, please. See if you can find any happiness in there. Okay. Leave it alone. And after a while, the mind finds happiness for you. Okay, mind. Make it really happy and really still. Calm, calm, calm. And then the breath disappears and this beautiful nimitta comes. And then you tell the mind, shh, don't disturb it. And the mind says, yes, I will. That's how you deal with the mind. Just every now and again, just a tiny little nudge and encouragement. As if you're working with like a good friend, not as if you're trying to control an enemy. That's not controlling. That's actually nudging and encouraging. Okay? Next question. This body is not mine. This mind is neither mine. What is mine? Nothing. And where is the Lord Buddha now? Where the Dhamma is, that's where the Lord Buddha is. That's why. That's a very lovely phrase. Because that's sometimes, especially going to Singapore and sort of Malaysia, people complain about sort of the Christian fundamentalists there, and they say that Jesus is still alive, but the Buddha is dead. There's no more. Is the Buddha dead? Aha. Was he living in some world, somewhere? Aha. The sutras say, he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. He who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. And that's a quote I like to use. So if you can see the Dhamma, you can see the Buddha. If the Dhamma's alive, than the Buddha's alive. Not the person, there's something much deeper. That's why you can actually say, where is the Lord Buddha now? Where the Dhamma is, that's where the Buddha is. Where the Buddha is, that's where the Dhamma is. Where is the Dhamma? The Dhamma is in the heart of the lotus. Right in the center of you. In the center of time, now. In the center of all this thinking and silence. In the center of the breath, where the nimitta lies. In the center of the nimitta, where the jhanas lie. In the center of first jhana, you find second jhana. In the center of second jhana, third jhana. Going through the jhanas, centering to the middle, like the petals of a lotus, until you get to the thousandth petal of the lotus, the innermost petal, and the Dhamma is right in the middle of that. The meditation is opening up the petals of a lotus one by one, going to the center of things, to see what is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. That's the Dhamma, that's the Buddha. That's where you see the Dhamma, that's where you see the Buddha. That's where the Buddha is. Okay? Go find him. And that is, the body isn't yours. It belongs to nature. The mind isn't yours either. It belongs to nature. Just cause and effect, that's all. What is mind? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You owe nothing. You're completely bankrupt. Isn't it wonderful to have so nothing? You have nothing, got nothing to protect, nothing to be afraid of. Make sense? Okay, next question. Can you please elaborate on what you've said many times? That tranquility and insight are the same. Thank you, Elaine. Okay, similes. Going up the hill to my monastery. Those of you who come from Singapore, haven't been to the monastery, please, if you've got the chance to go up and see Bodhnyana Monastery, go up there twice. First of all, go up there in a car and look through the window. Then go down again and next time walk up. And see if you walk up the same road as you drove up. You'll be surprised that it's absolutely completely different. All of you have actually driven up to that monastery. Hands up, those people, anyone here who's walked up that hill to the monastery. Okay. You lazy. Next time you go to the monastery, down at Serpentine. So get out of the car at the bottom of the hill and walk up. And see what it's like. So you understand this simile. You've gone up there so many times, like I've done, so many times in the car, and one day to start to walk up. And I was taken aback. I live up there, I've lived up there for 20 years now. When I walked up there the first time, it was going up a completely different road. It looked very, very different. Then I stopped, stood still. It looked different again. What the heck was going on? Was I hallucinating or something? What was going on was, in a fast car, you're only seeing flashes of scenery. The mind hasn't got time to fully understand things. And actually the world is quite grey when you're going fast. The colours haven't got the time to be really rich. It's like all pastels. When you walk out there, you're going slower, so you see much more. You've got time, space, to get more details, and what you see is richer. The colours are more vibrant. But when you stop and look, the senses have got all the time it needs to fully impress on the mind what's out there. You see all the details, and it looks so beautiful. Much more beautiful than when it's in a car. When you're in a car. And this is what samatha and vipassana are. When you're going fast, you can look outside and you think you can see things. You think you can get some wisdom. But all you're seeing is flashes of the world. You can't really understand at all. You don't have time to get the detail. When you slow down and slow down, you start to see more. See more detail, but also what you see is richer. You get more happiness, more beauty. That's one of the landmarks of samatha. More happiness, but also more richness of what you're seeing. And when you fully stop stand still. That's samatha. That's jhanas. You've stopped. Then you look and see with fullness. There you see all the details. And my God, it's beautiful. So not only just delicious and great fun, but that's where you see in fullness. You don't know that hillside until you stop and look at it. You can go up and down there for 20 years and you don't know it. You stop once and then you can fully see. That's why to see deeply you have to stop. That's why samatha vipassana go together. The slower one goes, the more one sees. The more one sees, the slower one goes. They work together. That's a simile from real life, so you can actually understand what I mean. If you haven't got stillness, you just don't see things. You think you do. You can assume you do. You think you know anicca, impermanence, rising and falling. You're just seeing it, just not in full detail, just seeing just a shadow of what real anicca is. You get still, stop, and then you know what I'm talking about. Just like, you know, that simile that went Wat Nana Chao in Thailand, where I trained the monk, getting into deep meditation, just doing walking meditation in the sala, on the concrete floor. Those of you who went there recently, it's such a shame they put plastic tiles on my beautiful concrete. Oh, it's such a shame, because underneath those plastic tiles is the most beautiful concrete you've ever seen in the whole world. At least that's how it looked to me once. I was walking in meditation, the mind got so still. Wow, look at that. It's incredible. You know, the greys and the textures, the colours, the shapes in that concrete was out of this world. And I stopped and just gazed, just in awe, and the most beautiful scene I'd ever seen in my whole life. A piece of concrete. And you're not really going out of your mind, you're actually going into your mind. And what's actually happening there, the mind was so still, you could actually see so much detail of something which you just pass over as being inconsequential. The mindfulness became so powerful, you could actually just dive into that concrete and just see just how gorgeous it was. And you have those experiences, hopefully in this retreat. See this carpet in front of you? Wow, look at all that. The concrete, the carpet just opens out and becomes the most amazing, wonderful thing when you're still. If you're moving, you can't see it. That's why samatha, the calmness, opens out the world to you. You see far more detail. It's like you've got a huge, powerful flashlight which just illuminates everything. My goodness, look what's going on in there. If you want to find out the nature not of a carpet but of you, who you are, where does this come from, what is will, what is the knower, what is the universe, life, that's the sort of mindfulness you need to see so deeply, so richly into things. And that's how you can just watch a candle flame go out, and then that's enlightenment for you. You saw that candle go out when I blew it out. Did you get enlightened? Why not? Keep the ghost you got enlightened. Because your mindfulness isn't strong enough. You didn't see it deeply enough. If you can see a carpet become the most beautiful thing in the world, then maybe when I blow the candle out, you can see that that's nibbana. And you nibbana with the candle flame. That's how it's vipassana, how they go together. Any questions on that? Okay, next one. Here we go. How do you deal with the ups and downs of monastic life? I go up in the car, I go down in the car. Especially the changes in conditions, the uncertainties and the association with the dislikes and discomforts, and still saying words happily. Okay, because I don't live in a monastery, that's why. My body lives in a monastery, but I live in my mind. So it's just a different way of looking at things. So, you know, you work in a monastery, but that's not the main thing I do. And, you know, when I go to Singapore, I'm not an abbot anymore. When I'm in Singapore, I'm a spiritual patron of the Buddhist fellowship. But when I come here, I'm not spiritual patron of anything anymore. I'm not even an advert. I'm not spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Whoopee! I'm just a meditation teacher. When I go into my room, I'm not even a meditation teacher. So I leave all these questions out here. Do you understand how you let go? Why do we carry around these burdens and responsibilities all the time? That's actually what just makes us crazy. We carry around so much we don't need to. I don't need to be the spiritual patron of Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore here. I don't give a damn about the Buddhist Fellowship when I'm here, basically. Nor about the Buddhist Society of West Australia. And just the Buddhist monk teaching the retreat, that's all. But when I go to Singapore, then I really give everything I've got. You know, as Singapore people know. It's doing one thing at a time, practice. That's how you deal with the ups and downs of mercy, right? So if things go up, it's great, marvellous. You know, just lots of people coming, lots of donations, fine, we do all these things. And when things go down, no one comes, no donations, it's great, I can have a rest. So it's a win-win situation for me. Sometimes we think that way, you know, just, you know. I think it was actually Ajahn Sumedho who said this once, because there's so many people going to this monastery saying, I'm going to make a scandal, he said. He did do it, he would do that, he could do that. Just to get rid of people. You know, do something really, really disgusting or something, so no one will come again to give him a bit of peace. But no, he won't do that. Anyway, next question. Do you usually get into jhana every time you meditate? Nah, come on. I'm not supposed to say this after that question, so that's one I'll pass. This is reason is because we've got this rule. It's the eighth rule in the Pajitya section of the monk's vinaya. So you can look it up. I'm not making this up. Which says like a monk can't claim personal experience of these states to lay people. We can tell our monks, tell fellow monks, but we can't tell Telipapa to lay people. So if you want to know what I'm doing, never ask me directly. Ask one of the other monks. That's how you find out. So that's actually the trick of finding out how a monk is. You can't ask them directly. You can ask me what sort of that monk is doing. Now, I might not tell you, but at least it's not breaking the rules. Strangely, I felt very attached to something I gave away. I did not feel it. Strangely, I felt very attached to something I gave away. I did not feel attached to it until it was gone. How do I come this pain of separation? Is that your husband or what? Okay. It's true, isn't it? Because sometimes I want to get rid of this guy. Anyone want him? Take him to the second hand, you know, garage sales every year. Going cheap. The pain of separation, it shouldn't really be pain, because if it really is you let go of something, it's one less burden to worry about in life. So you know, never think of it as yours. In the world, you know, people actually, I think it's mostly conditioning, because we're supposed to have lots and lots of things in the world. When we get rid of something, sometimes we feel guilty or we feel the pressure of our conditioning that we've actually lost something important and that's painful. We've failed because we've lost something. In this world, you know, you're supposed to be successful if you get lots of things. I think that's actually failing in life. The biggest failures of life are the ones who've got the biggest mansions, the most money, the most number of cars, and the biggest headaches and medical bills for their stress. They're the ones who are the losers in the world. They've lost the plot. They're losers. The winners in the world are the ones that are simply. They've just got, you know, just the ordinary amounts. They're the winners in the world because they live with more peace, with more freedom. So if you have the good fortune to be able to lose something, somebody goes into your house and they steal your television. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Now I can have some silence every evening. I don't have to watch The Bill. I don't have to watch All Saints. I can just actually sit meditating every evening. Oh, isn't that great? You know, the thief has done me a great favour. It's such good karma that someone's robbed me of my television. That's actually one of the monks. He was really attached to his guitar. When he went to Thailand, somebody stole it. He said that allowed him to become a monk. He said if he hadn't stolen his guitar, he'd have never become a monk. Isn't that a wonderful story? That thief made lots of good karma. But so, there's a question here about overcoming the pain of separation. Be glad you'd be separated from another bird in life, one less thing to look after. Just contemplate your death. You don't take anything with you. So at death you have to let go of all of these things. So you're just getting ready for dying. Every time you give something away, it's getting ready to die. Letting go of your attachments and possessions. Finishing off all the old business. And it takes years to do that. That's why it's good to let go now. So when it comes time to die, you've got everything out of the way and you're free to die at peace. So if that makes sense, that's why I've got quite a few other questions to go. Ajahn, absorption and jhana, is it the same experience? Yes. They call it absorption, that was just a translation of another word. The commentary is apana. They called it absorption. And the reason they called it absorption is because there's a sense of getting absorbed into the oneness, into the bliss, into nothingness. So that's just a very decent description of the experience of the jhana. You get completely absorbed into this non-dual bliss. This is absolute oneness, power, bliss for long periods of time. Because you're fully absorbed into it, it's a sense of you've disappeared. You've melted into nothingness. Just like when the sugar gets melted into your coffee. You can't see it, you can taste it. Now I've got a question in Thai here, this is going to test me. Korna Matsagan. By Nga, by Swap, there, my turn. So, by, maybe you can answer this tomorrow. I'll have to translate it first of all. Okay, I just want to know, because I haven't translated it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, before you became a monk, what were your meditation experiences, your deepest meditative states, I mean? And what is it like with most people before they become inclined towards ordaining? Thank you. Can you tell that experience before your monk? I'm not sure. Okay. That very nice meditation before I become a monk, but I won't say exactly what it was. So my first meditation retreat. And just that was actually one of the reasons why I became a monk. When you, at least there was more bliss than I'd ever felt before in your meditation experiences. And I had a pretty steady girlfriend at the time. And you know, sexual experiences, and that be orgasm, basically. Just you know, to be crude about it. Meditation was much better than playing around with your girlfriend, and that sort of you know, blew me away. What's going on here? This is much more pleasure. Why did somebody tell me about this? And so that sort of stays with you when you get sort of that degree of pleasure and bliss, and you think there's something's going on here, and you know, you wanted to. Experiment with it, find out about it, investigate it more deeply. And obviously you know, it was quite clear to me, if you really wanted to really put a lot of time into those sorts of states of meditation, you should go off and you know, be a professional, be a monk, because everything was set up there for deep meditation. So that's why I went off to Thailand and become a monk and found my way up to Ajahn Chah's monastery because of my good karma, and actually find out that you know, these deep states of meditation, that's what this path is all about. You're supposed to bliss out. Being with the forest teachers was great because they were doing that all the time. And that was actually the reason why they were in forests. You know, away from places, because it was conducive to deep meditation. It was why they had all this simplicity. So you didn't have to worry about you know, building great big monasteries with marble and gold and chandeliers dripping everywhere which had to be cleaned. It was just simple and practical, just for the purpose of meditation. And why you had all this time, heaps and heaps of time with nothing to do except to sit and meditate. And that's actually why you went in caves, away from the world, in remote places. So that was you know, having those experiences as a layperson and going off to the monasteries in the Forest Edition, you realise what those Forest monasteries were about. You know, what their heart was, why they were in those places, and what the guys in those monasteries were doing all the time, why they were celibate. There's a lot of like debate these days with like, especially with Christianity, you know, should the priest be celibate or not? Where did that come from? It all came from Buddhism, but the celibacy which comes about through practicing deep meditation. If you can get more pleasure by sitting on a cushion and blissing out, why would you ever worry about sort of, you know, the opposite sex? It's troublesome, you know, with sort of, you know, with a woman or with a man. And you all know what I mean. It's just emotional involvement and goodness knows what else, and babies as well. You never get babies with babies. So, you know, if you have the opportunity and ability to get into deep meditations, what would you need sex for? You become stupid. You've got something much better, much freer, less problems and difficulties. That's why there was celibacy in Buddhism. There's a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya which has said that unless you get at least first jhana, there's no consolation in monastic life. It's beautiful the way it said, consolation. It was Ananda speaking. So otherwise, that, you know, you've got no pleasures actually to counteract these sexual desires and the sensual desires. But once the monks get into those deep meditations, then this week, you know, they're sort of, you know, they're able to counter, you know, sexuality because they've got the pleasure which is nicer. So, you know, why, you know, give up the nicer pleasure for something which is coarser? So that's what Nanda said, sorry, it was the first consolation. Second is second jhana, third jhana, and all these stages of enlightenment. So if you get to those jhanas, then you're happy in monastic life and you'll probably never leave. No, you will never leave unless you lose your jhanas. So that's, what's it like with most people before they become inclined towards ordaining? It's many people become ordained for many reasons. Sometimes they get sort of like a taste of those. They may not get the full state of meditation, but at least get a taste of it. And they think, well, this is really worth pursuing in life. Now, why do you actually go out there and get married anyway? Why do you get your jobs and have families? Why do you build up your career? Do we think that that's where we're going to get fulfillment and happiness? And that's for most people, that's all they know. If you know something a little bit more than other people know, then you realise, hang on, I'm going to go for monastic life. Much more fun if I make it. And that's what many people do. They have like a taste or an inclination. There's actually something in this, which is not just, which is blissful for a start, but it's also very, very profound. And they get all the answers to the questions of life about rebirth and reincarnation. Now, is there such a thing? You find that out for yourself. Absolute vindication from your own experiences in meditation. Find out who you are, what this world is all about. It'll all be done. Isn't that marvellous? You can actually do that. You don't have to believe in a book. It's not revealed from outside of you. It's revealed inside. Not a revelation, but experience. Anyway, you said that the person who practices a sutta sees corpses. How can one see corpses? How to practice to see corpses? Thank you. I can see 50 corpses in front of me. Two to my left, one to my right. You know, those of you who have been to the ordination ceremonies, you know the five first meditations for a novice? Remember those ordination ceremonies? Same joke I say every time. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. And why are those the first five meditation subjects which the Buddha taught young novices? Because hair of the body is dead. Same as hair of the head is all dead. The roots are underneath. They're alive. But what you see, if I see all your hair, those of you who've got hair, that's all dead stuff. The same as your nails and teeth. They too are dead. The roots are underneath. And the skin, which I see in front of me, that too is dead. Because the live part of the skin is a few millimetres or so underneath the surface. So when I look at you, I see dead hair, I see dead skin, I see dead teeth. I see dead nails. I see corpses. And you can't fault that. And those of you who still live in the world, who go and kiss people, you're just kissing a corpse. Because when your mouth touches skin, you're just dead stuff. That's what you're kissing. And when you stroke your lover's hair, it's just dead stuff again. So that's... I love getting into this. It's all dead stuff, isn't it? The live stuff is underneath. So that's why it's the first five meditation subject. Because what's on the outside is all dead. It's a corpse. So you can very easily see it corpses. Because all the outside is already dead. Inside is still alive. But you can't see that. That's hidden by the outer skin of a human being. So I see, see corpses. How can we see? That's one way I can see corpses. And that's one how you can practice to see corpses. So the next time, you know, that all you young anagarikas or young men, you see this beautiful lady passing by, you know, have a look at this dead stuff. That's why they have to wear makeup to hide all the dead stuff underneath. So there's a corpse going past. There's this monk in the time of the Buddha who did sort of the asupa just on teeth. And this teeth became such a sort of an important meditation for him that that's all he would see. And this is in the sutras somewhere. And this man sort of had an argument with his wife. And his wife, a very pretty young lady, ran away. And she ran away, and sort of after a while the husband sort of went after her. And this monk was going along the same road and said, "Did you see my wife?" He said, "No, but I saw a pair of teeth going past." That's what he saw. It's just a pair of teeth. There's something attached to it. Anyway, next one. I hear much talk of thoughts. What of emotions? Sometimes when I sit in meditation and go ever deeper inwards, I'm met by a wall of emotions that have been busy from my past, that have something I am busy, that I have buried from my past and need to be released, dropped over the side of the balloon basket in order for me to progress. I'm not thinking anything nor reliving anything. I have learned to let them arise as tears or whatever, knowing that they will pass. Surely sometimes we have to release emotional blockages as well as our thoughts to access the happiness. Please comment on emotions, crying, etc., writing during meditation. Okay, if during meditation time those emotions come out, just let them go. Don't play with them, don't stop them. Neither encourage them, nor restrict them. Just let them be. Because sometimes that we get involved with those emotions, we buy into them, and actually we're encouraging them. We're not letting them be. We're indulging in them, basically. If you really just let them go, as if there's somebody else's emotion. As if it's somebody else's crying, not mine. It's not my emotions, somebody else's. So you allow them to be. You allow them to disappear. Especially if they're negative emotions. If they're positive emotions, get in there and indulge in them. As much as you can. Positive emotions, such as loving kindness. A tiny bit of loving kindness gets up in mind. Really get into it. And indulge in that. Make a lot of it. If like faith comes up, you get inspiration, indulge in that. Really get off on it, because it's a very powerful force which only leads to good things. And of course, if the emotion of bliss comes up, that's an emotion, that's the one to really make you cry. Wow, get into that one. That's a huge one. And if peace comes up, peace is an emotion. It's a subtle emotion which many people don't recognize as emotions. If peace comes up, encourage that emotion and really get into it. See how peaceful you can become. That's also part of the past, coming up into the present moment. So don't just go trawling the past from all the negativity, because you know there's no end to that. There's no end of traumas from the past, from this life, future life, previous lives, and stuff like that. A lot of it actually make the past traumatic. Now we look at the bad parts of it, like the bad bits in the wall. For me, I always choose the good bits in the wall these days. Why choose the bad bricks? Why choose the bad emotions? How about releasing the good emotions from the past? That's why I say, beginning of meditation, think of the most peaceful time you've ever had in your life. Really, that one. Don't go around the worst thing that's happened to me in my life. Think about the most peaceful time you've ever had, the happiest moment, the time you've been closest to Nirvana. Bring that up and indulge in that one. That's positive. Again, sometimes we get in the habit of being negative to disturb ourselves, thinking we don't deserve peace. And that's very often why we trawl up bad emotions from the past, or we think of bad emotions from the past. Just like I was saying, that Thai lady whose mother was a Chinese Thai used to go to the Chinese movies every week and would come back with red eyes because she'd been crying all the time, because Chinese movies are always sad. The boy never gets the girl never gets the boy. It's the family getting involved all the time. Stop you, it's true. And she would go to these movies every week without fail. And she knew what was going to happen. She knew it would be so sad. And she'd cry her eyes out. She loved it. Absolutely crazy. Masochist. Why would you go there to torture yourself? She loved it. She had to go every week to cry her eyes out. It was just so sad. I think the women will understand that. The men think it's crazy. Because we sometimes indulge in our emotions. We obviously like the nice emotions. If we can't get a nice emotion, we'll have a bad one. That'll do. So if you're going to indulge in emotions, choose a nice one. Choose like peace or loving kindness. The time when you was most content in your whole life, the time when you're most inspired. All of those of you who've been to the holy places in India, how about revisiting those? Wow, up the Vulture's Peak at dawn. That's a good emotion to get into. So choose the good ones. Don't go trawling the bad ones. Leave those alone. Well, after a while, you don't have to deal with them all. If you get to be a stream winner, they're all gone. Become enlightened, you don't have to deal with them ever again. So that's where you make it, they call it ahosi karma. Karma which is absolutely gone, can't reach you anymore. It's interesting, why do these memories come up? It's always memories because we're resonating. If we've got a really happy mind, we only resonate with happy memories. If we've got a negative mind, we resonate with the negative memories. That's why we trawl those up. So if these bad emotions come up, bad times from the past, a lot of times it's because it's similar, it's something common with what you're experiencing now. It's a sign you're not happy. So if you get lots of happiness up, you only resonate with the happy times of the past. If you keep that happiness, then you can't resonate with the unpleasant. It's gone, it's finished. Can't meet you anymore. No matter what happened. That's how you become free. And I've gone on too long, except for the Thai questions, so please I'll do this one tomorrow. I can read Thai, but it takes a bit of a while to actually to translate it to myself. So, that's this evening's questions. You see, I've got lots of energy this evening, so I hope you enjoyed those questions and answers. There'll be more tomorrow night, more coming. So, stay tuned, same place, same channel, next time. Sponsored by the Buddhist Society of West Australia. So now is the time for more meditation. The night is still young. Saturday night is supposed to be the fun night of the week. So this is entertainment night, Saturday night at the Redemptorist Monastery. Good entertainment, good meditation. Have a nice time. And see you tomorrow morning.